about 3 days later, and I said, I'm finished. He said, finish what? It's in my inventory. He said, Richie, how old are you? I said, 45. He said, now, it took you 3.5 months to get to age 13, and it took you, like, 1 week to get to age 45. What happened? I said, well, I realized that after I was 14 is when I really got fucked up. I've been fucked up ever since, and now I'm okay because I'm in the program. He said, well, I think maybe you should take another week. Maybe there's something there that you don't want to write about that may come out. Just do the 15 minutes a day, you know. And what it was, my first deep, dark secret, was that when I was 15 years old, I was basically brought up by my mom and my grandfather. And when I was 15, I was working after high school part-time in a factory and feeling good because I made a lot of money and my mom was in the hospital. And I used to come and she used to boast about how much money I contributed to the house and stuff like that. And I was still just, you know, barely in high school. And her and my grandfather got sick at the same time. And they were in the same hospital. And my grandfather died. And they called me up at work and the foreman told me. And I went to pieces. And so bad that I was living in New York at the time. And I was taking the subways, and they were afraid to let me go home by myself on the subway, so the foreman drove me home. And it was a big thing for me because he was really like a father to me. Exactly 30 days later, they came up to me and said, your Uncle Joe just called and said that they want you home because everyone's going to visit your mom at the hospital together. And I thought that was kind of unusual, but I said, okay. And I got on the subway, and I started thinking, that was strange because they wouldn't, like, call me from work or something. I said, I wonder if something else is wrong. I wonder if she died. And then I said, wow, if she dies, I'll be like an orphan. And everyone will feel sorry for me. And I'll get a lot of attention. And I'll get her insurance, me and my brother. Like, I know she got a lot of insurance. And I won't have to work in this stupid factory. I could do what I want to do. I said, I hope she died. And I got home and I found out she died. So for all those years, I carried that burden of guilt that I killed my mother. That because I wish she was dead, she died. And how could I ever tell anybody that, see? So that was number one. Then once I wrote that down and got it out on paper, I felt free. I felt really free about it. But I didn't know how free I was until I shared it with another human being, see? That's the real freedom that came from me. Now my other one was, my other biggie, was now this, my first sponsor was a guy at the time was 10 years sober in AA, 5 years abstinent in OA, maintaining over 100-pound weight loss. He was originally from Texas, and his experience was as an alcoholic that he was in and out of jails. He was the closest thing to a chainsaw massacrist or whatever. I mean, he was like really... salt and battery and this and that. He was like Mr. Macho, you know what I mean? And he was like Rambo before Rambo knew what he was. So one of the things, when I was in the Army, I went in the Army at age 17, and I wasn't exactly the spiritual giant that I am today. And I ran into some guys in the Army, and I was easily influenced because I was always eating and getting stoned, who told me of this great scam they had. And this was after I got back from overseas. I was in Washington, D.C., and they had this great thing where we could cruise the gay bars in Washington, D.C., and you pick up gay guys, you go home with them, and as you're about to have sex, you beat them up and rob them, and they're all in the closet. They don't want to report it to the police because they're afraid to admit, you know, they're gay. And this was 1953 or so, you know, so in those days everyone was in the closet. So those were the nice things I did, and a couple of times, you know, I had sexual encounters with them before I did it and this and that. And as I'm writing, I'm going, now how in the hell am I going to tell this guy that I was with, you know, men all these times? I go, I'll deal with it when the time comes, but I got to get it all down. So then I wrote the rest of my inventory, and a couple of months later I was ready to share it. So for some reason, one of my biggest gifts in this program is the confidence and trust that you people have put in me. When somebody comes to me and tells me they want to share their innermost secrets, it boggles my mind, because I was such a distrustful person. I was just so somebody, the last person in the world you would trust with anything. And today, people trust me with their innermost secrets. They trust me, and that's a gift. So that's how I felt about my sponsor. I just felt that this guy would not judge me no matter what, that it would go no further than him no matter what. So here I am, like 2 years ago, what I'm sharing today, I shared in front of 2,000 people at a convention in the Concord Hotel in New York, which shows you how my secret that I was going to take to the grave, how much I really care about it. You know what I mean? So what happened was this loving, and this is something, you know, at my very first meeting, I talked about the lady that hugged me, told me keep coming back. So it reminds me that I have to be out there for newcomers. I try at every meeting to just go up to a newcomer and introduce myself and tell them how much the program has done for me, or whip out my pictures and say, this is what I was like when I got here, and then let them look at me the rest of the meeting. And that's all I have to do, see? I don't have to say another word. But those are the kind of things. So when I look at the tolerance and patience and kindness and understanding and all that stuff that my sponsor exhibited with me, whenever someone says, if you got a minute, as soon as I go, well, I go, sure. Because no amount of time, no amount of energy that I could ever give to anybody in this program could ever equal what I've gotten from everybody in this program and from the 12 steps and from God. So there is no time that is too much, no amount of patience, no amount of listening that is too much for me. And I remember that from you guys who tolerated me. I mean, I used to go to meetings and suggest to someone, let's smoke a joint after the meeting. And they would go, well, not today, but keep coming back. You know, they didn't throw me out. They didn't tell me I couldn't do that. The only requirement was to be here, to have a desire to stop eating. So if you're in here today and you think you're a bad person because you had a candy bar for lunch or 20 of them or 60 of them, we don't care. Where else can you go and get up at a podium and say, I just had a quarter Häagen-Dazs, I threw it up. Then I ate a whole pizza, and I threw it up. And then I threw my cat out a four-story window, and I set fire to my brother's bed. And we applaud, and we hug you, and we tell you to keep coming back, you know? So that's reason enough to keep coming here, you know what I mean? No matter what I did to try to have you throw me out, son of a bitch, you kept telling me to keep coming back. So keep coming back, it gets better. And speaking of inventories, before I started on this one, someone asked me to lead a meeting. Now, I was in the program about 5 months. I lost about 150 pounds. And I didn't know anything else except that the meetings were great, the people were great, and I was losing weight, and I wasn't hungry, you know? So someone said, we want you to lead a meeting. And I said, look, I don't even know. What is that prayer that starts with the God shit? They go, the serenity prayer. I said, I don't even know that. They go, don't worry. It's in the format. You could just read it. I go, but I don't know anything else. They go, well, you've done an inventory, right? I go, oh, no. What's that? They go, a fourth step. I go, I don't think I did. They go, oh, well, you can't lead the meeting unless you do a fourth step. Now my ego, you know, they got me, they want me to lead a meeting. I go, well, I'll do one. What do I have to do? They go, well, just, you know, get a sponsor, etc. And I go, well, I can't do it this week because I'm going up to Santa Barbara, and I'm like going up there to relax. And just they go, what a wonderful spot to do an inventory. The mountains and the ocean and the serenity. Who could ask for anything more? And I said, great, I'll do it. Now, there was a girl in the program who I wanted to impress. So I asked her if she would take my inventory if I did it. She said, sure, I'd be glad to. So I went up to Santa Barbara with a lit of grass, and I got stoned, and I wrote this insanity, you know. Now, mind you, I was still drinking, smoking, chain-smoking cigarettes and getting stoned every day. And I used to do cocaine to get up for my pitch at the meeting, you know. And you guys said, keep coming back, you know, keep coming back. So I asked her to share the inventory. We went to this lovely little park in Santa Monica, next to a duck pond, you know, the perfect setting. And I read this gibberish to her. And she just kind of stared at me for about an hour, you know. And she smiled. She said, "Keep coming back." You know, so I did, you know, I did. Now, here I was. I had this searching and fearless moral inventory done. And I was going to share it with this guy who I really trusted, that he wouldn't judge me or anything. And it was easy until I got to the part about my mother. So I shared it with him and told him what I did. And he said, "Shit." He said, "Let me tell you something." He said, "My brother and I not only wished our parents were dead, we planned 2 or 3 times how to kill them for the insurance." He said, "We never did it, but we planned." I said, "You're kidding me." He said, "No." He said, "Why, you never wished like your kids were dead or you wanted to kill them? Don't you think your kids wished you were dead?" And I went, "Not my little angel." "Why, of course not." He says, "Well, when we get finished with this, I want you to ask your kids honestly if they ever wished you were dead." He said, "So," he says, "you're not the first person and you won't be the last that felt that way." So, of course, I had to compulsively do it. And I got Stacy and Gwen together. I said, "Now, I want you guys to tell me honestly, did you ever, like, think about what it would be like if I died? Like, say, sometimes I wish I could kill them." They go, "Oh, yeah, but we wanted to make sure that we were your beneficiaries first." So I said, "Thank you for your compassion." And you just, you know, and it's just like we all think that we're the only ones that do these terrible things. So now I got to the gay affairs part, right? And I was a little bit nervous, but I was able to read it instead of look at him. I was able to go, he said, "Could you go a little slower?" You know, and I told him what I did. So he said, "Well, let me ask you a question." He said, "What's your sexual preference today?" And I go, "Oh, you're kidding, women." I said, "I love women. You know, I couldn't, you know, get enough of that." And he said, "And would you beat somebody up and rob them?" And I go, "No, no chance that I would ever do." He said, "Well, I guess you're not the same person you were when you did these things, are you?" I go, "No." He says, "Then I guess you could forgive yourself for being less than perfect and not being a perfect parent, not being a perfect human being." He said, "But let me read you something." And he read me this little meditation that said that all of our sins of yesterday are forgiven and gone if just for today we live the way God wants us to live. So he said to me, "Do you believe today that you're living the way God wants you to live?" I said, "To the best of my ability." He said, "Do you think you're a loving person today?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you think you're a mean person, an angry person?" And all those I could answer, "No." He said, "Then I guess the sins of your past are gone, and all you have to judge yourself on is how you behave today. And so far today, you've been, you know, a child of God." And I said, "Right." And ever since then, I've let all that stuff go. I mean, there was a period of 9 years that I was away from my daughters. I wasn't, not only wasn't I capable of being a father, I wasn't capable of being a person. I was just totally anesthetized, totally into all my diseases. I was in trouble with the law. I was in trouble with gangsters. Everyone was looking for me. It was so funny. I never shared it. I once went down, this is so funny, I was like 400 pounds, right, with this voice. And I went down to Atlanta, Georgia, because I was running from Shylocks and bookmakers who were going to break my legs and stuff like that. And I shaved my mustache and cut my hair and thought nobody would recognize me. And I stayed at a YMCA in Atlanta, Georgia. And that's the length that I went to. And in that period of time, my ex-wife had cancer. She had remarried. And she died. And nobody could get in touch with me because nobody knew where I was, not even my own brother. I didn't, you know, I didn't want to take that chance. So I came back and found out, and here I had these two little girls who at the time, let me see, were like 12 and 9 years old. And all I could think of was they didn't have a mother, they didn't have a father. But they did have a stepfather who had remarried 3 months after my wife died, which is a whole other story. But I wanted to go up and play, you know, the white knight and rescue my kids and all that. And fortunately, I had people who loved me enough to tell me that that would be destructive, that I had to do it another way. So I contacted the stepfather and I told him that I needed to talk to the kids face to face. The only time I ever went to therapy in my life, I went to a group, and it was at Duke University. And the therapist there told me that I needed to tell those kids that I loved them, no matter how I had behaved or whatever. They had to know that they had a father that loved them. If they spit in my eye, that was none of my business. My business was to let them know how I felt, that I was too scared and too incapable of contacting them before this. So I contacted them, and as a result, today, I love my relationship with my daughters, but what I'm trying to bring out is I made my amends to them. And I remember so specifically, and that's why I love Stacy so much, because she's so perceptive. I made this amends to her and told about how sorry I was that I wasn't there for her and this and that and all this stuff. And she said, "Dad, I've heard that bullshit from you before. Show me." See? And she made me aware that what I needed to do was change my behavior. And a lot of my amends, I found out, was simply a change of behavior. To stop, instead of telling all these people how I wasn't going to mistreat them anymore, to stop mistreating them. It was that simple, you know. So I have forgiven myself. See, God doesn't forgive me because God never judged me. He's loved me all along. I don't believe that God forgives me because he never judged me. God has loved me all along. It's myself that judged me. It's myself that couldn't forgive myself. So once I forgave myself, it's fine. And I know that both my daughters have not forgiven me for what I've done in the past, but that's for them to deal with. I can't help that. I can't be them. I could only be me. I know that just for today, I'm the very, very best father I could be. I'm the very most loving human being I could be. I love and unconditionally accept those two kids to the pits of my heart on a daily basis to the best of my ability. And that's all I have to be. And I'm not worried about the 9 years that I wasn't there, because obviously I wasn't supposed to be there. You know, and I try to convey to my daughters that I too was a victim. I didn't have any parents at age 15 or grandparents. I had one brother who was not, you know, Wally to Beaver. He wasn't the kind of brother that I thought he should be. It wasn't father knows best, you know what I mean? And I resented him for that until I realized that it was my unreasonable demands of him that caused me all this anger being upset all the time. That my inability to accept him exactly for who he is and where he is. Today I love my brother to death. This is a guy who 50 times was mentioned in my inventory as Bert the asshole. You know? And today, Bert hasn't changed one iota. But I love him to death. And he's terrific. I can't believe how terrific he is. He's not an asshole. He's a child of God that behaves like an asshole once in a while. But that's his business. He's happy the way he is. He, you know, he thinks, you know, his son, my nephew that I mentioned, stayed with me a while, really got to understand where I was coming from and tried to tell his father, and, you know, his father also calls me Billy Graham. You know, my brother says, "I know you're grateful, right?" I go, "Right." You know, and it doesn't matter. You know, again, he's not right or wrong or good or bad. We're both different. And I could love him to death, and I do. I love him to death, and his behavior has not changed one bit. That again, all comes from the inventory. So now I did this fourth and fifth step stuff with my sponsor, and for me, what I had to learn was that I am a rationalizer. That if you would say to me, "Do you think you're a jealous person?" I go, "Why? Not me. Jealous, you know." But when my sponsor sat there and said, "Well, would you think that resentment, there was a little jealousy in there?" I go, "Oh, yeah, I could see what you're saying now. Yeah, you know." He goes, "How about this one? You think that maybe you were jealous of your brother?" I go, "Yeah, you got a point there. Maybe there was a little, you know." And I recognized that, gee, I got a lot of character defects, don't I? You know, he said, "Yes, but we have a solution, you see. We're going to give you the spiritual action that you could practice to get rid of these defects." I go, "Oh, what's that?" He said, "That's called step 6 and 7. See, he said, "We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects." He said, "My experience is in recognizing that you have them makes you entirely ready." Because I didn't recognize that I had any defects of character until I did this stuff. And then I realized that, like it says, where was I? Selfish, controlling, demanding, self-seeking, fearful. Boy, I was all those things, see. But that was, you know, for my first inventory. And time flies when you're having fun. I'm cool. Okay. I'm just trying to get some semblance of time in here. Who cares? Okay. So anyway, so now I got to like knowing that I had these character defects. Then I'll just say fair. So I did this whole inventory and I grew a lot from it. So now about 2 years later, I was sponsoring like crazy. And if anyone's having trouble with that, now I came to the point where here I am. Not only did I lose almost 200 pounds and keep it off, not only was I this physical specimen, but I was this giant of spirituality. You know what I mean? And everybody needed to be sponsored by me. And the book says that you can't keep it unless you give it away. And anyone who called, how could I possibly say no? See? So I was sponsoring about 372 people. And I felt kind of overwhelmed. And I went to a lady who has over 20 years of abstinence who sponsors 786 people, right? And I said, how do you say no? And she said, well, how many years are you in the program? And I said, let's see, 4 years, I think it was. She said, okay. OA is 25 years old. You are 4 years old. She said, do you realize that for 21 years people have been recovering without you? I said, thank you very much, enough said. You know what I mean? And since then I have found my balance with how many people I sponsor. But in that path, I sponsored this guy who was kind of a guru in AA. He had about 10 years sobriety and was, you know, speaking at a lot of out-of-town things. And he gained about 150 pounds in sobriety. And I had sponsored his brother in OA, and he saw a lot of spiritual recovery in his brother. And most of all, he saw a lot of joy for living in his brother that he didn't have. So he asked me to sponsor him. And I took him through the steps the way I had learned to be taken through. And we got to step four, and I shared my experience. You know, and that's another thing. I used to worry about what am I going to say when they asked me to speak at a marathon. And my first sponsor said, you know, similar to what I said before, you pass your pictures around and you stand there. He said, anything you say, he said, is, you know, gravy. But what you get to do is you share your experience. You don't have to be a lecturer. You don't have to be, you know, a preacher, a teacher. You just have to be a person sharing your experience. So that's what I get to share. So I was sharing my experience to him and how I did my inventory chronologically. He said, well, can I share something with you? He said, I've learned to do inventories exactly the way it's explained and how it works in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, you list the people, places, things, and institutions that you're angry at. He said, then in the second column, you ask, why am I angry? And in the third column, you put, what does it cause? How does it affect me? It affects my self-esteem, my security, my, you know, etc. He said, and then you go back and you do the fourth column, which is what were my mistakes. So I said, gee, that, okay, do it that way and we'll share it. And when he shared it with me, I realized that even though I had done many inventories, I had never really done it the way the book said to do it. So I decided, why not try it? You know, it's like I'm still growing up. And I did it, and that was the inventory that really got me in touch specifically with my character defects, the exact nature of my wrongs, and amends that I thought I didn't have to make that I had made that I needed to make again. So that's how I learned. And then later on, someone came to me and said, Richie, I'd like to share with you about an Al-Anon inventory I have. I go, I'm not an Al-Anon person. He said, oh, no, but you're the person I need to share it with. I said, no, I'm not, you know. And he said, no, you are. He said, trust me. So he had this inventory called the Blueprint of Progress, I think it is, from Al-Anon. And he started reading, and the first questions were, how do you deal with your spouse who is not an alcoholic or who is an alcoholic when you're not? And I go, see, I don't know anything about that. I don't have a spouse. And he goes, just listen. And he was one of these guys that always wants to shock you. He came up to me. Prior to that, he had come up to me and said, I have this little 10 step I want to share with you. He said, but I hope it doesn't shock you, you know. And he started talking about, you know, making it with chickens and, you know, this and that. And I remember this great story I heard somewhere in OA where we all think that we're so terrible that no one ever did what we did. And this guy is sharing his inventory with his sponsor and he goes, and I made love to a chicken. And he said, was yours dead or alive? You know, and it's like, and someone else said the other end of that is, was it frozen or thawed out? You know, and it was like, so it's like, you know, nothing can shock me anymore and nothing shocks anyone that I think would shock them. So he's sharing this stuff with me. And as we got on, I realized more and more, boy, I really relate to some of this stuff. It got out of the spouse Al-Anon stuff into some real heavy-duty uncovering of yourself and how your progress is going in that. So that was like about 6 years ago, and I've been doing one of those practically every 6 months for the last 5 or 6 years. It's just something that happened to me in my path. So now, after all that experience, now I'm sharing with my sponsor, and we listed my character defects, and now we're listing my amends. He says, now here's what you're going to do. You're going to go back here and you're going to see this person. And I go, there is not a prayer in hell that I am ever, ever going to go with this guy and tell him I'm sorry for anything. I said, no chance. And he said, you're right. I go, oh, sh-. He said, today there's no chance that you could do that. But we're only on step 6, Richie. Step 7. He said, when you get to step 8 and 9, you'll be ready. I went, bullshit. He said, well, take it a step at a time in order, right? He was right. See, the reason that day I knew I couldn't make any of these amends was because I was full of anger, still full of pride, still full of, you know, justifiable anger, unforgiving, uncompassionate, misunderstanding, and all those things. So I had a lot of character defects to work on. And the more I worked on them, you see, the more I substituted love and forgiveness for anger, the more willing I became to make amends to people. The more I substituted faith for fear and courage for fear, the more I realized it was no big deal. The more I, you know, practiced the faith and hope that God could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. Someone once said to me, courage is fear that said its prayers. See? And I know that the promises of the program come after step 9 and then tell you that you suddenly realize that God is doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself. And I remember when I first started making amends, right? I would go up to somebody and I'd say, hi, I'm in this spiritual program called Overeaters Anonymous, and part of that program is that I need to go back in my life and make amends to those that I've harmed. And people would look at me like I was out of my mind, you know. And I would go, and if I've done anything like that, like the time that we went to Malibu together, and I did this, I'm really sorry. And they go, are you finished yet? Can I go home now? Right. Okay. And nobody ever reacted the way I thought they would react. And then by rehashing these steps with people that I sponsored and reading these books over and over, something in those amends steps really stood out to me. And in the big book, in the chapter Into Action, it says, the real true essence of amends is a sincere desire to right our wrongs to people we have harmed. And that's all we have to do is have that sincere desire. So since then, I have that sincere desire. I don't have to worry about how I express it. And I think most of my direct amends in the last few years, or the last 5 years since then, have been to say to somebody, look, you know, I was just looking back at my past and realized that I may have behaved like in a manner that like absolutely got you angry or upset. If I did, I'm really sorry. But I'm not the same person, and I'm going to try to treat you differently. And they would go, you never did anything to me. I don't, you know, and this and that. And that's, you know, the essence of it to me is a sincere desire to right our wrongs. Now, I'd just like to expand a little bit more on the amends part of it, which is some of my favorite things are different kinds of amends. Now, as I've shared, my parents were dead. My ex-wife was dead. All this happened before I came in the program. So you guys taught me that there are ways to make amends to those loved ones that are gone. But what someone taught me when I regretted that I couldn't make, you know, eye-to-eye amends with my ex-wife, with my parents, whatever, was they said, make sure that everyone who you still love that's living gets to know how you feel so that when they die, you won't have any more regrets. And trust that those loved ones that you didn't get to make amends to are up there with God putting in a good word for you, you know, saying, hey, that's my boy. You know, because I always thought my mother wouldn't even want to admit I was her son. And now a lot of times, like when I get into these real, you know, unsettling situations with my daughter, with my grandson, I feel my wife going, you did pretty good, man. You really showed that kid what love is about. I'm really proud of what you did. As much as we had a lot of anger and hatred when we split up and everything, and as much as I wasn't there for her when she was sick and whatever, I really believe today that she's gleaming about the kind of father I am to her kids today and to her grandson and stuff like that. And those are the kind of things. I've written letters to each and every one of them. I've gone to the cemeteries, to the graves, and done what I had to do. All from suggestions of people at meetings like this. And that's why after I finish sharing, I'd love to hear everyone else share about their experiences with step 4 through 9. It gives me new ideas and things to do. So anyway, fortunately, through the grace of God, I was in a series a few years ago where I made an awful lot of money. And as a result, we had 2 weeks off for Christmas and New Year's, and I was working. There's another whole story that I may get to about Gladys Knight. I was working with Gladys Knight, and they were appearing in Atlantic City for New Year's Eve, and they said, wouldn't it be great if we could all get together? And I made a decision to go back east, where I have a small family. My brother, I have one brother and his family, and I have... my mother had one brother and one sister. I never really knew my father's family. And they both died, but their spouses are still alive. And they were real good to me when my mom died. They took me in and tried to help me and stuff like that. So I made a decision to tell everybody in my life, in my family, that I loved them. Because a lot of them are getting really on in years. You know, they all lived in New York, and then they became the mandatory age. They had to move to Miami Beach. You know, it's like mandatory. You get a certain age, you got to move to Florida and retire. So most of them lived in Florida, including my brother was moving down there at the time. And I went, and I sought out every aunt, uncle, and cousin. And I just sat across, and I said, you know, Aunt Blanche, I may not know how many grandchildren you even have. I don't know their names. I said, I don't know anything that's been going on the last few years, but I just need to tell you that I love you a lot, and I really appreciate all the help you gave me as a kid. And we got to all cry and take pictures, and they all said, I did nothing for you, and I said, you'll never know how much you did for me. And they did do a lot. At the time, I thought they were being a bitch, but they did a lot for me, and I knew that afterwards. And I got to tell every living loved one in my life that I love and appreciate them. And that's a form of amends that we don't talk about too much, but it's a gift. It's a gift from God. It's a gift from this program. And till this day, I still don't write them or see them hardly at all. The only difference is I used to be the black sheep of the family that everyone was ashamed of. Then when I became a movie star, I was everyone's aunt and uncle. I got more nieces and nephews who I never met. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, that's my Uncle Richie. You know what I mean? So that's the gift that I had in that area. And then I went back east, and it was so funny because that same year when we went to Atlantic City, I took my middle nephew and my best friend, and I told them that I would pay for everything except the gambling. And the treat was on me, and that we were going to spend New Year's Eve with Gladys Knight and the Piffs. And we went there a day early. There were no hotels because it was the holiday season. And a friend of mine called and said, are you going to Atlantic City? And he said, what a gift. He said, I got this condo that nobody ever uses. So I had this two-bedroom condo, carte blanche, for the days we were there. And I said to my nephew and my friend, I said, you know what we'll do when we get there? I said, I'm sure that one of my friends will be at one of the other hotels, like Melissa Manchester. You know, I have a lot of friends in the business that are true friends. And the first billboard we see is Dom DeLuise is appearing at Bally's, right? And Dom and I have done 5 or 6 movies together, and we're good friends. So I called Dom up, and he was so excited. He said, you got to come over right away. We went over. We spent that day watching him rehearse, seeing the show, and having an intimate dinner with him and his family. And all we talked about was God. You know, it was just a real touching experience that I don't have time to tell the details about. And then the joy of sharing the love. Gladys Knight and her family are the most spiritual people I ever met, the most unconditionally loving people. And as a result, I got to share that with my nephew and my best friend and them. And that's the joy of living that I get through the program. You know, it's not just this marathon stuff and that. It's out there, folks. I mean, my joy of living is the freedom to be in a place like Palm Springs that I know nobody except in this room, and the willingness that if I'm in the mood tonight, I'll go to a disco by myself and not have to worry about eating peanuts and potato chips or drinking, but worry about how many women I can ask to dance. You know what I mean? That's the joys of living. It flows out in there. It's not just in these rooms. I remember a couple of years ago when I was in that series, the long hours that we spent shooting, I was writing dialogues with God, and I wrote, gee, God, I'm really sorry that I can't be at meetings and lead them and be a secretary and this and that and carry the message. And God's answer was, Richie, I got plenty of people in these rooms carrying the message. I need people like you out there with those hardcores, with those Hollywood people, man, who really need to see an example of God. You know, and one of the cliches that I heard was, you know, be careful of how you behave out there. You may be the only copy of the big book that people ever see, you know. So that's my job. I get to be a channel of peace and hope and faith and light and love. I get to be involved in a series where there was a lot of friction on the set. And I could remind them, I could say, hey, we're supposed to have fun. And they go, all right, we're supposed, you know. And it would, like, give a little levity to the situation. It would make people back off from the selfishness and the anger and realize that this was, you know, part of the joy of living. And that's what I do now when I work. The best thing is I worked with a director recently, and he said to me at the end of the shoot, he said, you know, he says, as an actor, I can't believe how disciplined you are. You're right there. You're right where you're supposed to. He said, but the real joy, he said, was crossing paths with you and getting to know you as a human being. He said, it was a wonderful experience. So I go, thank you. Thank you. And I know again that I did my job. See, that's what I look for. I look for people to tell me that meeting me was a spiritual experience or a nice experience, not how wonderful I am as an actor or this or that, what I am as a human being, that I'm a loving human being. And that all comes from, you know, this constant practice of the steps. So anyway, now I'm still on amends. Now my favorite kind of amends is that I had a lot of things like, I was a thief, I know a lot of people that need to go back to Woolworths and write anonymous checks and tell them I stole school supplies when I was 7. If I did that, I wouldn't have time to do marathons. You know what I mean? It would be a marathon. I would have to hit every store, you know. So again, I've come to, there are some financial amends that I definitely had to make, and there were some I had to come to the conclusion that my behavior today is my amends. You know, I remember sharing, what's the desert place, the rehabilitation house in the desert? Yeah, the Metamorphosis House had a marathon in L.A. they asked me to speak at, and I was honest. You know, I say things that I have to listen to the tape to know what I said, because they go, I said that? And I shared that day about how I would go to a 7-Eleven, and I'm a sick person. My mentality says, they're going to charge me an extra quarter for gum, more than Ralph's. Well, that means I got to steal a pack to get even. You know what I mean? Has nothing to do with the fact that I'm lazy, that I don't go to Ralph's to get it at the cheaper price, that I'm in a hurry, and has nothing to do with them. So someone came up to me after and said, Richie, you can't do that. I said, do what? They said, keep stealing gum. I said, what makes you? He said, you share that you steal. I go, oh, right. They go, would you do me a favor? Just like any time you want to steal a drum, think of me and say, I can't do that. So a day at a time, I haven't done that ever since. You know what I mean? And those are the kind of amends that I have to make, is not to go back to every 7-Eleven that I stole a drum and give them a quarter, because I don't remember. So one of my favorite amends is that, you know, again, I was not the spiritual giant that I am today. And in my disease, I was very impatient and mean to senior citizens. When I lived in New York, I drove a cab. And in New York, when a light changes, it's not like here that the pedestrian has the right of way. That means they're fair game. So most people are getting on in age. In New York, the lights change so fast they can't make it across in one light. So I used to get real impatient and wait till they got right before my cab and blast the horn and try to give them a heart attack, see. And I scared some people, you know, but not to death. I don't remember anyone falling. They may have had something afterward. So when I shared that with my sponsor, he said, well, this is what we call a living amend, Richie. He said, what you can do is the rest of your life, be kind, go out of your way to be kind to senior citizens. Can you handle that? I go, absolutely. So as I shared earlier, I went for 3 years in L.A. without a car. And people say, you can't live in L.A. without a car. Wrong. You not only can live, you can enjoy it. I used to write these dialogues to God at the bus stop, and I get pissed when the bus came, I wasn't finished, you know. Then I can get on the bus, and I can enjoy the view. I could study scripts, things you can't do when you drive. So in my course of riding the buses, I was working at CBS in L.A. in Beverly and Fairfax. Now, any of you who are not familiar with that area, the average age is deceased on Beverly and Fairfax. And they move very slowly. And they're wonderful, loving people. So I was waiting at a bus stop with about 40 senior citizens, and the bus pulled right in front of me. So I stepped aside and invited everyone to get on before me. And this one lady about in her 70s said, what are you doing, Buster, checking us out? And I went, yeah, as a matter of fact, you're kind of cute, you know. And she went on in the bus, and I got on, and she went, over here, I got a seat for you. And she saved a seat for me, and she said, listen, I just want to tell you, you're kind of cute yourself, except for that greasy mustache and hair. You ought to get rid of it. I said, well, you know, I need it for my business. Now, the next stop, a lady gets on, very frail-looking lady with two shopping bags, and the driver's already yelling at her because she couldn't find her senior citizen's pass. And I don't know about, you know, in Palm Springs if you have buses, but in L.A., they, like, kind of peel out, you know, the drivers. So as this lady's fumbling for her pass, this guy peels out and she starts to fall. So I jumped up and I grabbed her bags and held her and I said, are you all right? And she says, get your grubby hands off me, you molester. Go feel your mother up. You know. So I was like totally embarrassed and I like slinked down into my seat and my girlfriend there said to me, gee, that was terrible. She says, I thought you were really being helpful. And I looked and I said, trust me, I had it coming. You know what I mean? So it's like, so that's God's little humorous way to make sure that I maintain my living amends, you know what I mean? And what goes around comes around, I guess, you know. But it's great because today I am aware that I have the ability to be extra kind, you know, to a senior citizen. And what gets me is my daughters remind me that I'll be qualifying at Sizzler soon to get a discount, you know what I mean? So I have to be kind to myself, you know. So, and it's like those are the gifts that this program has given me, you know, and those are what amends are to me. But most of the amends are living each day the way God wants me to live according to the principles he lays down for me. So the principles behind all these steps, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, is, you know, first of all, we went over honesty, hope, faith, and courage. Okay? It takes a lot of responsibility to go back through your life and list your defects of character and list the amends to people that you have to make. And to go back and make those amends is a very responsible act. And I was never a responsible person, but today I have that gift of responsibility and dedication, so I don't have to be irresponsible anymore. Then the patience behind it. to, you know that it's aiming towards the best we know or can learn. And the only way that I can remove my defects of character is to practice the spiritual action instead. And I just like to say that one of the things I do on a daily basis is, and I guess I'll get to talk about this when I talk about step 11, my experience with prayer and meditation and my improving my conscious contact with God. But what I do every morning is I get on my knees no matter what. And the last prayer I say on my knees is the seven-step prayer. My Creator, I am now willing that you have all of me.